years. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the House would vote next week on the legislation creating the proposed panel. At the same time, she plans to move ahead with a vote on a long-awaited bill that would provide $1.9 billion to bolster the Capitol's defenses, reimburse the National Guard and other law enforcement for protecting the complex in the attack's aftermath, and cover costs relating to the coronavirus pandemic. Republican leaders have not yet endorsed the spending measure either, calling it premature. But Democrats believe holding a prompt vote will force GOP leaders to the negotiating table. The measure's provisions include more than $500 million to reimburse the National Guard, which has supplied thousands of troops to patrol the newly fortified Capitol, $350 million to create retractable fencing and new security screening sites at the complex, $160 million for hardening windows and doors, more than $175 million to protect federal judges and courts, and $40 million to fund prosecutors going after suspected Capitol rioters. It includes smaller pots of money to equip Capitol police officers with body cameras and increase protection of lawmakers as they travel the country. Many of the initiatives were recommended by a panel led by Russell Honoré, a retired Army Lieutenant General appointed by Nancy Pelosi to investigate Capitol security. The Capitol Police promptly issued a statement saying the funding would help the department move forward to meet our evolving mission. The pair of measures and the protracted deliberations surrounding them underscore just how significantly the violence has rattled and reshaped Congress in the months since the riot occurred, including by worsening its partisan divisions. The attack was one of the most violent in American history. More than 140 police officers were injured. At least five people died in connection with the rioting. The Vice President and members of Congress had to flee for their lives, and the Capitol building itself was badly damaged. And initial reviews by congressional committees and other government watchdogs have already turned up troubling evidence of avoidable intelligence and security failures that made matters worse. Proponents of a bipartisan commission argue that putting outside nonpartisan experts in charge of the fact-finding will improve the investigation and help calm partisan nerves. Some senators, whose after-action hearings on the attack have been bipartisan, feel the need for another inquiry is less urgent. An independent bipartisan commission will remove politicization of the conversation and focus solely on the facts and circumstances surrounding the security breach at the Capitol, as well as other instances of violence relevant to such a review, Mr. Katko said in a statement. Republican Representative Katko is among the most moderate House Republicans and was one of 10 in his conference to vote to impeach Donald Trump in January for inciting the insurrection. His position mirrored that of another of the 10 representatives, Liz Cheney of Wyoming, who Republicans purged from their leadership ranks this week for her vocal repudiations of the former president's election lies and her party's complicity in them. Liz Cheney said that Republicans did not want a narrow investigation into January 6 because it threatens people in my party who may have been playing a role that should not have been playing. I'm very glad that they rejected Leader McCarthy's suggestions that somehow we should dilute the commission, Liz Cheney told ABC News on Friday, adding that Kevin McCarthy absolutely should testify before the body about a phone call he had with Donald Trump as the attack was underway. But the two Republicans appear to be in minority, Many of the party's loudest voices have undertaken a concerted campaign to downplay the Capitol riot and deflect attention from it by pointing to the unrelated actions of activists aligned with movements on the left. Representative Louis Gohmert, a Republican from Texas, offered the latest example on Friday when he took to the House floor for an hour-long speech that argued that the rioters who smashed windows, clubbed police officers, and threatened to hang former Vice President Mike Pence that day had essentially been peaceful. Representative Louis Gohmert from Texas accused the Justice Department of abusing its power to harass and punish conservatives who have come to stage a nonviolent protest that day, whilst going easy on the looters and destroyers in Portland, Oregon. The overwhelming number of people caught up in this, quote, unprecedented investigations, as the Justice Department promises, they're actually nonviolent, peaceful Americans, Gohmert said. Their only crime was supporting Donald Trump and concern about the fraud Democrats have been telling us about in elections for many years. The denialism have left Democrats furious and flummoxed over how to respond. One of them, Representative David Cicilline of Rhode Island, who served as an impeachment prosecutor against Donald Trump, started asking colleagues on Friday, 14th of May, to support a resolution censuring a handful of the Republicans who had been most outspoken in misrepresenting the Capitol attack. The deal struck by Mr. Katko also included concessions from Democrats. After pushing for an agreement that would have given their party more power to choose who would serve on the commission, they accepted a 50-50 split, in which each political party would appoint 5 of the 10 members. Subpoena power would likewise be shared between appointees of the 2 political parties.
Around the World with Reporters.
After a relatively quiet time on the Lampedusa island, with only a few migrant boat landings per day recorded last year, the number of asylum seekers arriving by sea in Italy has started to pick up again over the past months, to the point that Italian authorities are alarmed by developments in the area. Around 13,000 people seeking asylum have arrived in Lampedusa by sea since the start of 2021, up from about 4,000 in the same period last year.
The real issue here is not the number of migrants arriving in Italy, Malta, Spain and Greece, which is still relatively low compared to previous years, but rather the contribution one expects from all other EU member states in terms of solidarity. Lampedusa doesn't have the health facilities to provide assistance to thousands of migrants in this pandemic crisis.
Over 2,000 migrants landed on the Italian island of Lampedusa between Sunday and Monday. Following the arrivals, the European Union's Home Affairs Commissioner called on member states to show solidarity with Italy and support the relocation of migrants. However, a European Commission spokesperson has said that despite contacts with several member states, no specific pledge has been received so far.
At an ongoing conference organized by the Portuguese duty presidency of the EU in Lisbon, Italian Interior Minister Luciana Lamorgese has called on Brussels to find a long-term structural solution on how to manage asylum seekers. The minister has urged the activation of concrete, solid solidarity mechanisms, as well as a shared strategy to counter the smuggling of human beings and illegal immigration.
This is the other question of Lamorgese said also, humanitarian evacuation from Libya. They have already started, yeah, but again, it is dependent on the willingness of states to say, okay, I take 5,000 people from Libya.
According to Italian intelligence sources, there is an estimated 900,000 migrants in Libya kept in appalling living conditions in detention centers where abuse and torture are rife. About 1,000 people trying to reach Europe by sea have been returned to the North African country since the start of May. Max Civili, Rome.
After the Eid al-Fitr prayers, Yemenis came together outside the UN office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to state the demands of the international community to take real measures against the Saudi blockade on Yemen.
Yemenis celebrate Eid al-Fitr this year amid the continued aggression and blockade, and the sufferings of Yemenis are increasing due to the continued detention of fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has caused a severe fuel crisis. We regret to see the United Nations and the international community silent towards our suffering.
Protesters slammed Saudi Arabia for its continued detention of oil vessels that has left their country in a desperate struggle to survive amid the harsh shortage of fuel. They said Riyadh has to release their tankers to prove its good intentions for moving towards a political solution.
Piracy acts against Yemeni oil ships are continuing under the leadership of the United States with the participation of the United Nations. We are about to reach the end of the May, and the Saudi coalition has only allowed one ship to enter the country since the beginning of 2021. The United Nations bears full responsibility for the humanitarian situation in Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its allies imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since the beginning of the war in March 2015, depriving millions of Yemenis of their basic needs. The United Nations described the situation in the war-torn country as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Yemenis believe that the United Nations bears responsibility for their suffering as it provides the political cover-up for Riyadh and its allies. They say the international community must break its silence and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege from their country. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana'a.
In London, thousands hit the streets, furious at Israel demanding an end to the continued onslaught of Palestinians, while incensed at the evident bias in much of the mainstream media coverage, which is accused of shamelessly pushing the Israeli narrative.
There's a well-established channel between the Israeli government and between all mainstream news sources, meaning that they get threatened with legal action, they get aggressive emails and letters and even tweets from members of the Israeli government.
All the media pretty much has been disgraceful, and they buy this narrative that these are clashes between two hostile camps that are completely incomprehensible, as if, you know, both sides are equally culpable. What is happening here is a continuation, a deepening, an acceleration of Israeli aggression.
Organisations like the BBC, funded by the British taxpayer, claim to be impartial, but have come under fire for presenting the murder of Palestinians as an equal conflict of two sides, and in the past of yielding to Israeli pressure over the nature of their coverage, and of simply not doing their job of reporting the truth of the reality of the war against the Palestinians. While Israel shows no sign of stopping the attacks on Palestinian men, women and children, millions around the world are demanding an end to the slaughter, and that mainstream media, which maintains incredible influence over public opinion, tell the facts and the truth about the devastating, deadly impact of the brutalization of the Palestinians.
As Israeli occupation forces continue to kill innocent Palestinians, media outlets like the BBC stand accused of siding with Israel, presenting a false narrative which is a far cry from reality. Richard Soudan, London.
Scores of people have registered to take part in the 13th Iranian presidential election. On the third day, some reformist hopefuls turned up at the election office of the Interior Ministry. Former parliament members Ali Mutahari and Mahmoud Sadeghi presented their plans to the reporters.
Everyone, even the anti-establishment people, the supporters of the previous regime, and even the BBC reporters must be allowed to talk. Our red line is to create chaos, but making a speech is absolutely free.
I want to be the voice of the people based on the experience I gained from representing the people and the parliament, as well as relying on my profession, which is advocacy.
Mohsen Mehralizadeh was another hopeful who gave his credentials to the Interior Ministry to send his name to the Constitutional Council for final approval. He has served as governor and minister in different cabinets.
Social, cultural, and economic factors all affect the consciousness of society. If we can solve the economic problem in this country, the situation will improve. Economy is a priority of the country today, and if we pay attention to the economy and people are freed from this poverty, unemployment, and related problems, vitality will return to society as a result.
Ramin Mehmanparast, former Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman, also announced his bid to contend for the post. On the first 2 days, men with military backgrounds, including Mohammad Hassan Nami, ex-defense minister Hossein Dehghan, and the IRGC commander Saeed Mohammed also signed up to run. The other ones who showed up were former petroleum minister Rostam Qasemi, ex-sports minister Mohammad Abbasi, current deputy parliament speaker Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, and also some other previous parliamentarians. 2 days left until the end of the deadline to register for presidential elections, and some high-profile figures have not shown up yet. We have to wait and see that who are the final contenders to run. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
The legacy of the past in the north of Ireland still haunts the present, particularly as the victims of the violence are still searching for the truth. For the family of those killed in the Ballymurphy massacre in 1971, their fight, first and foremost, was to set the record straight, and after 50 long years, their wait was finally over. As a coroner inquest ruled that 10 civilians, including a mother of 8 and a Catholic priest, killed across 3 days, were entirely innocent. The inquest found that at least 9 of the 10 killed were shot by the British Army, and that the force used was disproportionate, considering the paratroopers were firing from protected positions from a long distance away.
The coroner's court heard almost 100 days of evidence from more than 150 witnesses to conclude what the families of the deceased have known for 50 years, that their loved ones were entirely innocent and should not have been shot dead that day. But why have they had to wait so long for this verdict?
While the families have been vindicated, the fight to bring the perpetrators to justice is still not over, according to Patrick O'Murray, a human rights lawyer who represents them.
Prosecutions have been very rare in this jurisdiction, arising from the conflict when those who perpetrated the events are state actors. Many families would argue that we have had a de facto amnesty for British soldiers and police officers, where they haven't been subject to the normal rules of the criminal justice system or the rigours of the law.
The families feel their loved ones were killed twice, first by the British soldiers, and then their characters assassinated by the British state. Inside and outside the court, the families cheered the fact that after a long and hard-fought battle, the truth had been acknowledged and the names of their loved ones exonerated. But their cheers were bittersweet because not everyone lived long enough to see this day. Ahmed Cabello, London.
In the wake of the Israeli regime's attacks on Jerusalem al-Quds, pro-Palestinian demonstrators took over Downing Street in the British capital, London. The demonstrators even managed to clear out a small group of pro-Zionist demonstrators and chanted in solidarity with the Palestinian uprising against the occupation, sending a strong message of international solidarity.
Outrage is what's being voiced here on the streets of London today after Israel's assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem al-Quds, as well as the attacks and the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. On top of that as well, of course, people are voicing their frustration and condemnation of the British silence over the massacres committed in the Gaza Strip.
Now they're attacking the Gaza Strip as well. They're attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque at a time when
in the middle of Ramadan at the most holy time for the Muslim people. This is an acceleration of the general attacks on the Palestinians, and it's completely unacceptable.
Since 1917, the British government has supported the Zionist project in Palestine, the settler colonial project that expelled the Arab Palestinians from their land, and which to this day continues to deny them their basic human rights. And today, now we see Israel is continuing this and ramping it up, and is now trying to expel people from Jerusalem, from East Jerusalem, which is occupied by Israel illegally.
Demonstrators also expressed their outrage over Britain's allowing for the production of weapons to be used by the Israeli military and the UK's historic support for Israel.
According to the arms trade treaty that Britain is a signatory on, they are legally obliged to assess whether the hardware that they're selling to another country is likely to be used for human rights violations. When, following the 2014 war in Gaza, where you saw the massacre in Shaja'iyah, Britain, within weeks of it, Vince Cable, the business secretary, rubber-stamped the sales of millions of pounds of weaponry to Israel.
With the Gaza Strip under bombardment as the armed resistance fires rockets at Israel, the Palestinian people rise up throughout the occupied territories. This is whilst the international solidarity seems to now be stronger than ever. Robert and Lakesh, London.
Messages of sympathy with the Afghan nation echoed from Tehran following the deadly terrorist raid on Saturday that killed dozens of schoolgirls in Kabul. Scores of people lost their lives in explosions caused by car bomb and mortar shells targeting a school in the Shia-majority neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi in western Kabul. Eyewitnesses reported that the victims of the attack were mostly female students headed on their way back home after finishing school.
I offer my condolences to the bereaved mothers of the innocent girls who lost their lives in the terrorist attack. I hold the Afghan government responsible for its inaction regarding terrorism and extremism.
We came here to express our sympathy with our fellow Afghan citizens. The fact that the terrorists committed to this heinous crime in the fasting month of Ramadan shows that they have no respect for Muslim citizens.
While Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for the Kabul attack, demonstrators here blame the incident on U.S. war of Afghanistan. They say American forces have been on the ground in Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But in fact, they've been fueling the flames of terrorism. Last week, the U.S. and its NATO allies began pulling their troops and military hardware out of Afghanistan, a measure which these people say is too late.
The U.S. is not willing to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, so it is always after creating chaos and insecurity by finding the extremists. They believe this way, Afghan people want American troops to stay to protect them against terrorists.
The U.S. is not willing to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, so it's always after creating chaos and insecurity by funding the extremists. They believe this way, Afghan people want American troops to stay to protect them against terrorists.
In a gesture of solidarity, Tehran also held this video mapping on its iconic Azadi Tower. The video projection depicted messages of sympathy with the Afghan nation.
A voice to lead, a vision for future. This is the theme for the 2021 World Nurses Day. UN has commemorated the international occasion as this year, like the previous year, the occasion is marked with a new awareness among the public and officials as nurses, along with other health workers, take the front line in the fight against the deadly coronavirus pandemic. Speaking at a press conference on the occasion, head of UN's nursing organization, Mohammad Mirza Beghi, said since the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, over 100,000 Iranian nurses have been infected with the deadly virus, but Iranian nurses have not quit their jobs.
Since the outbreak of the coronavirus epidemic, Iranian nurses have been at the forefront of the fight against the disease. More than 100,000 of them have so far caught the virus on duty, out of which 120 died of the virus. On average, 6,000 to 7,000 nurses are under quarantine due to getting infected with the virus. But as soon as they get recovered, they come back to work to take care of the patients. Such a spirit creates a beautiful picture of sacrifice in one's mind.
There are some 140,000 nurses in Iran. For hospital nurses, life under the coronavirus conditions has been much tougher and more challenging. These professional nurses have had to work extra shifts to make up for the shortage of staff.
I've been a nurse for 12 years, but the COVID-19 pandemic was the worst of what I had ever seen. I saw my colleagues losing their lives on a daily basis at the front line of the fight against the virus. Therefore, I decided to take photos of their sacrifices and hardworking efforts to take care of infected patients. My photo was selected by the International Council of Nurses as the best photo of the year in hospital category.
This global COVID-19 pandemic has shown the world the important role that nurses play in keeping people healthy across the lifespan. Therefore, nurses as the largest healthcare profession must play an integral part in planning the future of healthcare.
The World Health Organization designated 2020 as the Year of Nurses to celebrate the contributions of nurses to healthcare during the pandemic and acknowledge the challenges they continue to face as the pandemic ebbs and flows through human community worldwide. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The escalation of the Israeli aggression against the Palestinian people is awakening the people of the world to the true face of the regime and prompting people from all walks of life to emerge and raise their voices.
The women and the children, we all know, is disproportionately impacted by the violence that is happening in Al-Aqsa. And I think as women that we need to be able to stand with those women in solidarity, and that is why I'm here today.
I think the atrocities of the Al-Aqsa Mosque are a demonstration of insecurity and of awareness that the light at the end of the tunnel for Israel, for a Zionist state, is an oncoming train. For us, it's the daylight. The next phase in the struggle is drawing to an end.
South Africans have always highlighted the plight of Palestinians with numerous marches held to demand a stronger action from the government. While the ruling ANC has taken several policy decisions in this regard, it has largely failed to sign them into law. However, lobbyists are expected to put forward a bill in Parliament that will seek a boycott of Israel.
We want Parliament to discuss it as soon as possible and to adopt laws which will force everyone in South Africa, big business, universities, sports bodies, to have nothing to do with Israel.
The South African government has condemned the Israeli forces' raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and the planned evictions in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds. It slammed the move as being in breach of international law and several UN Security Council resolutions. But the country is yet to indicate any plan to downscale ties with Tel Aviv. The demonstration year forms part of a national day of action in which sister protests have taken place in Johannesburg, Durban, and other parts of the country. Protesters say they will continue their action until the government takes decisive steps. Hassan Siriep, Cape Town.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held funerals for civilians killed in Israeli airstrikes that targeted residential areas in different parts of the enclave. The Israeli army launched the attacks on the Gaza Strip on Monday. Children are also among the victims.
My relatives were playing next to their home and the Israeli airplanes hit them and killed some of them. We are really sad, but we are ready to sacrifice anything for Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's our right, and we are going to grab it from Israel by force, even if we die defending Palestine. We ask the resistance to respond.
God is greater than Israel. I lost my little son while my husband lost his legs. I'm totally speechless, and I can't believe this till this moment. The ongoing wave of violence broke out on Monday after Hamas issued an ultimatum demanding Israel remove its forces from Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The Israeli airstrikes came after resistance groups in the Gaza Strip conducted rocket attacks against Israel.
قوى المقاومة تدافع عن الشعب الفلسطيني في وجه العدوان المتكرر من قبل
Palestinian resistance will keep defending Palestinians with all means. What is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds is a crime, and the Israeli regime should get the punishment from Palestinians for attacking worshippers in holy places. Israeli regime is practicing terrorism policies in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Gaza Strip.
Palestinians have gathered here to mourn some of those who were killed in Israeli raids. As Israel keeps bombing and killing Palestinians, people here call on the international community to confront the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
U.S. government records show that Enrique Tarrio, chairman of the far-right Proud Boys group, received two federal government-backed Paycheck Protection Program loans worth a total of $15,500. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Jason Wilson. The piece is titled Proud Boys leader received COVID-19 stimulus loans worth $15,500. U.S. government records show that Enrique Tarrio, chairman of the far-right Proud Boys group, received two federal government-backed Paycheck Protection Program loans worth a total of $15,500. Enrique Tarrio, based in Miami, Florida, was approved for an initial loan of $7,750 on 30th of March this year, and a succeeding loan for the same amount on 16th of April. The loans were issued to Henry Tarrio and anglicized form of his name, which he has used on other occasions. The Proud Boys began as an organization protesting against political correctness and boosting their idea of masculinity, and grew into a right-wing group that embraced street fighting. Earlier this year, Canada named it as a terrorist organization. It is seen as having played an important role in the 6th of January assault on the Capitol in Washington, D.C. In the loan documentation, which was obtained by the news nonprofit ProPublica after a Freedom of Information Act battle with the Small Business Administration, Enrique Tarrio is described as an independent contractor working in the security systems services industry, but the document names no associated business entity. Additional information provided to The Guardian by ProPublica shows that the street address on the loan application is associated with both Enrique Tarrio and one of the limited liability companies for which he's named as an officer in Florida state records. Those records show Enrique Tarrio as an officer in a number of inactive limited liability companies, including Spy Security LLC, Fund the West LLC, and Proud Boys LLC. In a questionnaire he completed for the Ballotpedia website in the course of an abortive 2020 congressional run, Enrique Tarrio described himself as the proprietor of several companies that were involved in the surveillance and security industries. However, Tarrio was not found to be licensed security officer in a search of Florida state records. Another company, War Boys LLC, was voluntarily dissolved on 7th of April. Records show that Enrique Tarrio is the registered agent for that company, and Joe Biggs and Ethan Nordine are also officers. Joe Biggs, also of Florida, and Ethan Nordine of Washington State are jointly facing federal conspiracy charges relating to their alleged participation in the riot at the Capitol on 6th of January. In the lead up to those events, Tarrio was arrested and charged over weapons offenses and the alleged vandalism of a black church in Washington, D.C. at a previous election-related rally. Following these charges, Enrique Tarrio was banned from entering Washington, D.C. and did not participate in the 6th of January protests and rioting. No other Florida-based businesses are associated with a Proud Boys leader in that state's public records. Government-backed Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP loans, were first issued under the CARES Act in 2020, under the Trump administration, as a stimulus measure to an economy battered by the COVID-19 pandemic. The program was revived in January of 2021 under the Biden administration, and businesses were able to apply for loans up to 31st of March this year. Enrico Tarrio's loan was issued as part of a second round of government-backed Paycheck Protection Program funding. One criteria for eligibility was that recipients not be a business concern or entity primarily engaged in political or lobbying activities. Government-backed Paycheck Protection Program loans are forgiven when it can be shown that at least 60% of money was spent on payroll costs. Independent contractors can use the loans to replace claimed lost earnings and apply for forgiveness in order to keep the money. Although Enrique Tarrio took federal stimulus money, he has long been criticized as a key promoter of disinformation about the pandemic and measures to counteract its spread, including wearing face masks and lockdowns. In 2020, at the height of the pandemic's first wave, counterterrorism researchers at the Middlebury Institute noted that Proud Boys-related platforms showed widespread engagement with violent conspiracy theories, with disinformation and promotion of narratives that downplayed the COVID-19 pandemic. Enrique Tarrio did not immediately respond to a request for comment.
Africa Today.
The people of Nigeria are paying a deadly price for importing Europe's dirty fuel. The government of this most populous country in Africa has failed to stop the importation of these toxin-heavy fuel manufactured in Europe. Tens of thousands of Nigerians die every year due to pollution, and now the masses are saying enough is enough. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today. We are going to focus on how Nigeria is importing dirty fuel from Europe. This fuel is having devastating effects on the health of Nigerians and the country's environment. In the second segment of our program, we're going to talk about the ongoing conflict over Ethiopia's massive hydroelectric dam being built on the Nile River. This project is opposed by Egypt and Sudan. Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi recently warned Ethiopia of risk of conflict over its giant dam.
I am telling our brothers in Ethiopia, let's not reach a point where you touch a drop of water from Egypt. Because all options are open.
Join us till the end of our show as our experts analyze these issues.
Europe selling dirty oil to Nigeria. The Nigerian government has since 2016 been making repeated promises to end the importation of dirty fuel from Europe. Members of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, convened a two-day workshop in Abuja in June 2016 with the plan to end the use of dirty European fuels in their countries. According to a non-governmental organization known as the Stakeholder Democracy Network, Nigeria is plagued with some of the worst air pollution levels on the planet. In a report, this NGO noted that apart from damaging vehicle engines, the dirty fuel is having a detrimental impact on public health and national air quality. A Nigerian affected by pollution emanating from this dirty fuel speaks out here.
You wake up in the morning to black particles surrounding us and making us unhealthy.
For more on this subject, we have contacted J.C. Martin Manfur, a senior project officer for the Stakeholder Democracy Network, SDN. He was involved in SDN's research on toxic fuel. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, it's quite surprising to many that Nigeria, an oil-rich country, imports dirty fuel from Europe. What's the reason for this, Manfur?
It's surprising. Nigeria exports sweet, low sulfur fuel and, you know, gets in exchange of imports of highly sulfurous fuel. The reason is not far-fetched. The refineries Nigeria have are unable to produce enough fuel for the domestic consumption of Nigerians. So to subsist for this, the government has no option than to import fuel to augment whatever that is produced within the country. That has resulted in this this situation whereby a large bulk of the fuel that is being consumed in Nigeria is either imported from Europe or the ones that are artisanally refined within the country, which the government still term as illegal.
According to some estimates, Nigeria imports approximately 900,000 tons a year of low-quality, token-heavy fuel manufactured in Europe. According to some reports, the fuel being refined illegally in the bushes of Niger Delta is of a higher quality than the petrol imported into Nigeria from European countries. Now, why has the Nigerian government failed to fulfill its promise of ending the importation of dirty fuels from Europe?
It all has to do with structural, because Nigeria at the moment has four refineries, four government-run refineries, but they are poorly maintained. The government has put in a lot of money in towards the maintenance of these refineries. But what has happened is that it turns out to be a corruption-laden process where money is pumped into the refineries and they never get to produce anything. So that has hindered the ability of the Nigerian government to be able to stop the importation of dirty fuel. Currently now, the government is relying on a new refinery that's being built by Dangote Refineries, one of the richest men in Nigeria, to produce most of the domestic consumption of fuel in the country.
Thanks for your insight, Mr. Manfur, and stay tuned for more.
The European Union says it has adopted ambitious new targets to curb climate change. However, in a clear case of double standards, low-grade diesel imported from Europe to Nigeria exceeds daily EU pollution limits by up to 204 times. For petrol, the pollution emissions are around 43 times higher than legal EU levels. David Ogolar, the executive director of Africa Network for the Environment and Economic Justice, has been leading a campaign to stop the importation of dirty fuel from Europe to Nigeria.
The Swiss trading companies and other companies that are importing dirty fuel into Nigeria need to know that they do have a corporate social responsibility that is expected from them, that they should help to bring clean fuel to Nigeria.
Now, Nigeria is among many African countries still using dangerous, low-grade, high-sulfur fuels, which have long been banned in Western countries. So why are European countries dumping this dirty fuel in Africa?
I think it's cheaper for the process of refining fuel to remove the huge sulfur. It's more costly when compared to exporting it as it is. And unregulated markets such as Nigeria and the West African sub-region leaves open the opportunity for people to sharp business practices to send this thing to unregulated markets such as that in West Africa. So it's left for Nigerian governments to make sure that they tighten the standards that they have within the country. Then they will now be able to enforce and ensure that only quality fuel that meets their standards can come into the country. Otherwise, businesses who are looking for ways to maximize profit will always find ways to bring this sulfur-laden fuel into the country.
Clearly, it's up to the Nigerian government to stop these unscrupulous European oil companies from dumping their dirty oil in Africa.
Nigeria now has some of the world's most polluted cities, and this is partly due to the use of these dirty fuels from Europe. This dirty fuel is a major contributor to Nigeria's public health crisis, with the latest data suggesting around 114,000 people die due to air pollution-related causes every year. In Lagos, a World Bank study estimates air pollution resulted in 11,200 premature deaths in 2018 alone.
Now, Mr. Manfu, how is this dirty fuel from Europe impacting on the health of the people of Nigeria and the country's environment?
It has huge environmental and health impacts. For instance, the city of Port Harcourt, where I live, since 2016, have been suffering from what we term black soot, where particulate matter keeps is in the air and goes into the lungs and nostrils of individuals. So we've witnessed cases of increased respiratory-related diseases, asthma, bronchitis, and all that. And this has a huge impact on the healthcare burden in the states. You know, it costs people a lot more to take care of their health. On the environmental part, we have issues of due to air pollution, we have acid rain, which makes the environment unpalatable for people to live in, affecting, having impacts on the quality of the building materials that we use in building our homes, on farming and the quality of produce that can be produced from the land, which has become infertile from acid rain.
Well, in a move towards self-reliance in fuel production, Nigeria's Minister of State for Petroleum Resources recently said the government has embarked on the modernization of some of the country's refineries.
And you can see the milestone that we achieved last week. The Federal Executive Council has already approved the rehabilitation, comprehensive rehabilitation of Port Harcourt refineries, and we are on course to rehabilitate Warri and Kaduna refineries.
Now, Mr. Manful, do you expect the situation to improve in the near future?
I'll say yes. Two things and two reasons for that is, first, the ECOWAS sub-region is working with United Nations Environment Program is trying to push for the adoption of a standard for fuel use within the sub-region. So if this is adopted and member countries begin to enforce them, including my country, Nigeria, then we'll be able to make sure that only quality fuel can be imported into the country if we still need to import fuel. And that way, we'll reduce the amount of sulfur in our fuels that we use in the country. Another thing is what the government is doing now with, although it's a reliance on a private refinery, which has about 600,000 barrels per day capacity, which will be able to provide enough fuel for the domestic Nigerian market. And if that's done, Nigeria does not have any need to import sulfur laden fuel into it, because already the country has very low sulfur content crude oil within the country. So we'll be able to solve that problem in the medium to long term.
Well, clearly, the rehabilitation of Nigerian oil refineries will meet the country's domestic demand for clean fuels and curb its reliance on imports. Now we're going for a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the conflict over Ethiopia's giant dam on the Nile. Stay with us.
Missions of my life today. We are always walking through this door, but today we are cut off from access to our farm, and our worker needs food, so we gotta walk through the door to cross to get to our farm
to deliver some groceries.
Well, I don't need fun for your
Stop.
Life.
Man, always random things going on. So this is our Ramadan routine. Take you guys through a day in our life of what it's like Ramadan in the motherland. But first things first, we gotta go feed our amazing staff at the farm.
Deadlock over Ethiopia's dam.
Egypt and Sudan failed to reach an agreement at the last round of talks with Ethiopia over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Now, the talks were held in the Democratic Republic of Congo's capital, Kinshasa, early April. This latest round of talks was hosted by Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi, who is also the current chairperson of the African Union. Now, Sudan's Foreign Minister, Mariam Asuduik El-Mahdi, told reporters that Ethiopia's insistence on unilateral moves represents a violation of international law.
Ethiopia issued a statement accusing Egypt and Sudan of pursuing an approach that seeks to undermine the AU-led process and to take the matter out of the African platform. Sudan and Egypt have refused to take part in the Nile Basin Comprehensive Framework Agreement unless Ethiopia recognizes their right to oversee the use of most of the Nile waters, which a British colonial treaty of 1959 accorded to them. This treaty is also contested by other Nile Basin countries. The multi-billion dollar Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam has been a source of tension in the Nile River Basin ever since Ethiopia started its construction in 2011.
Now, for more on the protracted conflict over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, we have contacted Dr. Ashok Swain, a professor of peace and conflict research and UNESCO chair of International Water Cooperation at Uppsala University. Thanks a lot for your time, Dr. Swain.
My pleasure.
Now, what is the current state of dialogue between Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam?
The three countries have been negotiating to find an agreement of how to fill the reservoirs. This is a big dam, very big dam, how to fill the reservoirs and how to coordinate among themselves now for almost more than 1.5 years. And this negotiation has come to a standstill after it failed to get a deal through African Union-led negotiation, which was being chaired by Congo a couple of weeks ago.
Thanks for that insight, Dr. Swain, and we'll be right back.
The filling of the dam's massive reservoir is expected to commence during the upcoming rainy season, which normally begins in June or July. Despite opposition by Sudan and Egypt, Ethiopia's water minister, Seleshi Bekele, recently said his country will continue to fill a mega dam on the Nile River.
On second year filling, also it's very clear it has nothing to do with anything. As construction progresses, filling takes place. This is our commonly agreed, the Declaration of Principle. We don't deviate from that at all.
What are the major points of disagreements between the parties to the conflict?
The immediate disagreement or what is going on that for the last several months is whether the agreement will be a binding one or it will be just a memorandum of understanding. Ethiopia is refusing to make this agreement legally binding because I think the real reason, as I understand, is Ethiopia is fearing that if it gets into a legally binding agreement, it might not be able to develop the water resources in the future.
Internationally, the European Union says it supports the African Union in the quest for a negotiated solution on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. The United States also recently appointed veteran diplomat Jeffrey Feltman as a special envoy for the Horn of Africa. He is expected to join European powers involved in talks with the three countries.
however, Ethiopian Foreign Minister Demeke Mekonnen has expressed his country's categorical rejection of any attempt to force Addis Ababa to accept a colonial agreement with Egypt and Sudan regarding the Renaissance Dam. Mekonnen says exerting unnecessary pressures on Ethiopia by deliberately politicizing and internationalizing the dam dispute will not force his country to accept an agreement dating back to the colonial era. Now, Dr. Swain, do we expect an expanded involvement?